Hello, it's Claire Sturgis here, and I'm going to read a piece from Skeletons by Jane Fallon. Poppy unwound her scarf from her neck and then proceeded to wind it back round again more tightly. The day was sunny but deceptively cold. The leaves had already started to leave the trees behind, and they kicked them up underfoot as they walked. Jason strode on ahead with Poppy's 4-year-old daughter, Maisie, pointing out the ducks and the boats, occasionally grabbing her hand or the hood of her jacket when she strayed too close to the edge of the riverbank. "Do you think I'm getting a moustache?" Poppy said, out of nowhere. "Let me see." Poppy pushed her face close to Jen's, and Jen screwed up her eyes and scrutinised her sister-in-law's upper lip. "No, I mean no more than anyone else. There's hair, but it's blonde. I'd never have noticed if you hadn't pointed it out." "Shit, I'll have to add it to my list of things to get waxed." Jen laughed. "You can't see it. I should never have said." "No, you're the only person I can trust to tell me how it is." "Okay, so how about me?" Poppy peered at her. "I can't tell. I need my glasses." They walked on in silence for a few moments. "So I'm guessing you were looking at Jason this morning and thinking, what are we going to do with the rest of our lives now both girls have left home?"
"Which?"
"It's a syndrome. I read about it." "It might not seem ideal, having your sister-in-law for your best friend. There ought to have been whole areas that were taboo, subjects off the menu because they were just too revealing. But Jen and Poppy had a no-boundaries rule that they deemed essential if their friendship was going to trump their familial relationship. Luckily, Jen and Jason's marriage was largely drama-free, so Poppy had never been called on to take sides. Not so far. "It's just going to take a bit of adjusting to," Jen said now. "For both of us." "I bet you end up having another baby," Poppy smirked. Jen pulled a face that said no way. "We're going to run around doing all the things we couldn't do with kids in tow. Such as?" "I have no idea. Going dogging? Or taking drugs? What do unencumbered people do?" "I have a 4-year-old, don't ask me." "Maybe we'll go travelling, something like that." "What? Backpacks and Birkenstocks? I can't see it somehow." "I mean, more like a long holiday. Nothing too intrepid. Nice hotels and scheduled flights." "Can you afford to do that?"
"No."
"If I were you, I'd just enjoy the peace and quiet." Hi, it's Claire Sturgis, and this is a non-fiction piece. It's called Dead Straight Guide, Pink Floyd. It's like a Pink Floyd unauthorised biography. Introduction. If ever there was a band that eluded biography, it is Pink Floyd. They've sold over 200 million records, and their album sleeves are iconic and instantly recognisable. Yet the band can walk through the crowds at their own concerts unmolested, and their solo records struggle to sell a fraction of the parent band's worst sellers. This anonymity, this enigma, has been, to an extent, deliberate. All the members of the Floyd are inclined to be reserved by nature, or rather by English middle-class nature, and lights, projections, props and inflatables have long eclipsed the band as performers at live shows. Rick Wright said in 1987, "A Pink Floyd show is not the individuals, it's the music and lights." Indeed, enormous cheers greeted non-member Snowy White as the first musician on stage during the Animals tour. While the surrogate band of session musicians that opened the Wall shows put this confusion at Pink Floyd's conceptual centre. Then there's the fact that until the 1986 split between the band's guitarist Dave Gilmour and its bassist Roger Waters, Pink Floyd gave few interviews. "We don't really need the music press and it doesn't need us," a politely bored Gilmour told The Enemy in 1973. Add to that their decision to absent themselves from their own album sleeves, their 1967 debut, The Piper at the Gates of Dawn, and 1969's Umma Gumma are the only albums to feature the band on their front cover. And even then, the photographer on the former, Vic Singh, described them as there, but not there, while the latter deliberately confuses the eye as to which member is which. When Dark Side of the Moon appeared, the name Pink Floyd featured only on the poster included with the album. From Wish You Were Here onwards, they might as well have not existed. Drummer Nick Mason and keyboardist Rick Wright weren't even mentioned anywhere on 1979's The Wall package, while Wright's sacking before the final cut wasn't even perceived as worth mentioning to the public. There but not there. wish you were here. But in these attempts to counter the cult of personality that has such a negative impact upon original leader Syd Barrett, Pink Floyd have been almost too successful. After Barrett was replaced by Dave Gilmour with barely a commercial ripple, manager Peter Jenner said, "Dave could play better Syd guitar than Syd." Then history repeated itself when the Floyd reconvened in 1986 without Roger Waters. Despite all those satirical surrogate bands, it was a shock to the group's latter-day leader that fans regarded him as, well, just another brick in the wall. "I was slightly angry that they managed to get away with it," Waters said in 2004 of the resultant reunion album's sky-high sales and record-breaking tour receipts, that the great unwashed couldn't tell the fucking difference.